2nd, 2013. This is the Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight we will review the novel The Demonologist by Canadian writer Andrew Piper. Now, this is a recent mainstream thriller from Simon & Schuster that is surprisingly accurate in its presentation of demons working in the realm of the human mind, exploiting personal weaknesses and former tragedies to accomplish their ends. With some obligatory exaggerations for horror effect, but otherwise very authentic. Popular writers usually try to find some old Necronomicon book-alike to hang their story on. In this case, author Piper used John Milton's Paradise Lost. Now, at first, this seems like an odd choice. Why not the Key of Solomon or the Lamegaton or the Heptameron? However, Milton's long biblical epic is actually a very good choice. It was published in the late 1600s and was very widely read and dealt extensively with Satan and the fallen angels, even incorporating our Canaanite Baal and Astaroth, Baal and Astarte, into their ranks, along with the archdemon Belial, some people pronounce that Belial, who is the disembodied villain of Piper's tale. Now, readers of our Book of Solomon's Magic will recall that we quoted Milton's poem in relation to our Canaanite pantheon. Now, Milton, and to an extent Piper, tried to give Satan and his minions a credible, even darkly heroic point of view. This certainly influenced William Blake in his Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Blake, in fact, illustrated one of the later editions of Paradise Lost. So, if you want a demonic thriller that will make you wonder what you might have lurking between your ears, tune in tonight and we'll recommend one. Now, first let me say this. Andrew Piper is a very, very skilled novelist, and this is not his first by a long shot, and he knows how to write a thriller. And maybe he'll call in later. I hope he does. I'm going to ask him whether or not he is one of the many students of Dean Koontz's How to Write Best-Selling Fiction. I know Dan Brown certainly was, because he certainly has mastered the Dean Koontz formula for writing a thriller. And Dan Brown worked at it, finally got it right with the Da Vinci Code, and Andrew has it right with the Demonologist. There's a way to write a thriller, and Stephen King, of course, is one of Dean Koontz's favorite writers, and Stephen King, of course, does this. He knows how to set these things up, make them credible. One of the first things you have to do is have a credible protagonist that the reader can identify with and have sympathy with, and it is not some sort of a superhero. Stephen King made this point very, very, very well. In the same way that Dan Brown has his protagonist as an expert in symbolism, in this case, Andrew Piper's, his demonologist is actually a professor of English literature at Columbia University in New York, whose specialty is Milton, and especially Milton's epic poem, Paradise Lost. This is what he is specialized in and lectures on, and this, at first, you know, when I first got into this, I'll say, you know, I, I'm I have written and published some novels, and I'm a novelist, but I'm also more of a capacity, I think I'm an expert in this particular subject of demonology. Maybe I am. I don't know. But so consequently, I was kind of, when I got into this, I kind of thought, well, what is he going to do here? What is he going to do, another exorcist for us? Is this going to be another one of these things with where the demon, the poor kid gets the demon on a Ouija board, or no. What's going to happen here? So I read it. I start reading it with this jaundiced kind of view here, and I think, man, I get into this, and well, sure, he's setting it all up, and David Ullman is a professor with all kinds of problems that all this can relate to, and his wife's about to divorce him, and she's having an affair, and he's got a wonderful daughter that he loves, but that's about the only good thing in his life, and he's miserable, and he's fixated on melancholy. Which gives us a hint that there's something in his background. Right from the start, we realize that there's something tragic. There's something dark, brooding, and tragic in David's background. We know this. We gradually learn what it is. So we set both. We like him, and we identify with him, and we know because of the hints of his sadness and his problems and all this, we know there's something lurking in his past, something that's casting a pall. And he's also fascinated not only with Milton, but he's fascinated with the late Renaissance book, The Anatomy of Melancholy, which gives you an idea that there's something very sad, and maybe even something kind of mysterious in his background. So we know that. Now, but where are we going to get? All of that's fine, and I'm waiting. You know, what kind of demonology are we going to have here? Is this going to be another? Now we know he's Catholic too. So, and this, as this thing starts off, we realize that this is going to be some sort of thing that related to the Catholic Church in an obscure sort of way. So I'm thinking, oh boy, here we go with the Malachi Martin or the Peter Benchley kind of thing. Let me say this about that: Catholic, classical Roman Catholic cases of demonology usually involve some young woman who. It's either she's a kid in puberty with poltergeist, and the whole demonic possession is wrapped up with poltergeist phenomenon, and it's a result of parental abuse and sexual guilt and all of that all rolled up, and then they get hysterical and they become, if the extreme, they spit gallons of pea soup on the exorcist, and whatever. And so, is it going to be that kind of thing? Now, that kind of demonic activity is peculiar to the Catholic Church, and it seems to be what they seem to deal with, at least as far as we could tell. But that's not what most. That's not what most interaction with demons ends up being. I mean, those of us who are dealing with it in a broader sense, we know that's something that's kind of peculiar to the Catholic end of things. And I'm going, are we going to do this again? Is it going to be another rerun of The Exorcist? Well, no, it isn't. But at first, you're not sure. David Ullman, the expert on Paradise Lost and Milton, is contacted by a mysterious European woman, sophisticated, but frankly, she's a bit macabre. in the sense that you find out, well, I'm not going to spoil it for you, but you know, she's kind of like something out of, almost like something out of a Charles Adams, you know, the Adams family kind of thing. She's kind of macabre and very mysterious, and gives him a commission as an expert on an academic, and wants him as a consultant, and wants to pay his first class flight and all of his expenses to Venice, Italy, and to consult on a case for a client, and which she will not reveal, but which Ullman assumes has something to do with the Catholic Church. And he doesn't want to take it, but she gives him the envelope with the tickets and everything else, and won't tell him anything more about it. But then his wife falls apart, and his wife decides to divorce him, run off with an astronomer who is a, well, he's not an astronomer, he's an astrophysicist, and who is a jackass, and he's miserable. And so he ends up, because Andrew just got this divorce notice, and he's miserable, and his little daughter, he is, he wants to, he makes a very, very bad mistake, which at first I kind of thought it was a bit of a plot flaw, but then later I understood it better. He takes his 11-year-old daughter with him on this jaunt to Venice. Now, really, that's hard to get. I kind of winced when, I'm reading that one, isn't it? Because I'm a, I got a little girl too, and I don't think I would have done something like that. But he's going to take her along, and she can have a holiday in Venice and whatever. So he takes her along with him. And they get to Venice, and we get a nice tour of Venice. And by the way, just to mention, Milton, when he did the grand tour way back in the 1600s, when he went to Venice too, and he was involved in some kind of political intrigue in Venice. So Milton, who is David Ullman, the professor from Hughes, has already preceded him to Venice. Now, so in Venice, he is admitted to a very mysterious place, and mysterious things happen in one thing or another, and he finally gets into this decadently grungy, and that's about probably the best crude way to describe Venice is decadently grungy. This decadently grungy apartment, and here is this former colleague of his. He doesn't recognize him as a former colleague, an Italian professor, who is obviously possessed, and the professor, he's possessed by this spirit, and the professor. Like all good demons or bad demons, he knows, he knows David. He knows David, and he knows David's inner thoughts and all that, like demons do. And then he rattles off a bunch of numbers, and he says, "You'll know us by our numbers." He rattles off this string of numbers. Meanwhile, David has been given this camcorder to record all of this, including the numbers. And so he's pretty frightened, but he gets the camcorder, and records it all, and he gets out of there. But unfortunately, he brings it home with him back to the hotel. And sure enough, his little daughter, it jumps to his little daughter, and it's, she it isn't exactly suicide, but she dives off, does a dive off the top of a 14-story hotel and ends up in the canal, and she's gone, and that's it. So he's just grief-stricken and horrified and whatever. Flies back to New York. And now, what happens at this point is that we start to see, as he as he tries to find. Number one thing, he's convinced that his daughter may still be alive because they don't find her body. And he thinks she's still alive, but then a part of him seems to know that she's not, but he still wants to find her. And we begin to see, as this thing progresses, and this is one of the great, really great things about this book, and why it's a cut beyond, or several cuts beyond, the typical treatment of this sort of thing. Way beyond Body's Exorcist. I mean, it goes way beyond that, because David Ullman starts, because of this and these other tragedies in his wife and Lois, and all of this, we start experiencing, without being told in so many words, we start experiencing David Ullman's descent into insanity. Now, this is not easy. This takes a very, very skillful novelist to write this. One of the best examples of it was a novelist at the turn of the last century by the name of Robert Chambers, who wrote The King in Yellow and a story called The Repairer of Lost Reputations, in which the teller of the story, as the story progresses, you realize very subtly that he is going insane, and by the time the story is over, you know he's completely insane. This begins to happen. And yet at the same time, the phenomenon that David undergoes as this is happening is the kind of phenomenon that many of us, in fact, all of us can relate to. He meets people. He meets people who know, as strangers, who know more than they could possibly know about him. He meets people who he realizes are actually dead. He encounters these ghosts. He becomes desperately concerned about rescuing his daughter, but yet he doesn't go back to Venice to try to find her in the canal or out in the Adriatic or anything like that. He somehow or other imagines that the demon has got her. And we know, as this progresses, that he really realizes that she's on the other side. And as this thing, but yet this is very subtly done, and yet at the same time, we have the action, and we have the car wrecks and the car chases, and then there's a mysterious individual called the Pursuer who chases him, wanting to get the camcorder back. Of course, he's in the camcorder in a safe deposit box, you know, with instructions not to release it and down at a certain time, whatever. It turns out that the numbers, the series of numbers that the demon gave him that he recorded in the camcorder turn out to be stock market quotations from the particular date that the demon predicted that they would occur. So this confirms the closing stock, or the stock, the closing stocks all around the world. And this proves that, you know, this is proof that the demon's real, because he can predict exactly on the date, 7 days from now, he can predict exactly what the numbers will be on the closing of each stock exchange around the world, and he can predict them. And that's proof that he really is this omnipotent disembodied spirit. Now, it turns out, as we began to get deeper and deeper into this thing, that really what the spirit wants, I hesitate in a way to tell you what the demon's name is. I think I did on the abstract, but I hesitate because that's a spoiler. One of the things that David Ullman has to find out is the name of this demon. He has to find out. And actually, the name of the demon is, it reveals a lot about the nature of the demon. And I, being something of a demonologist myself, I kind of had a pretty good idea who the demon was before, but the average reader probably will not. And so we won't tell you. But anyway, it's a demon that we can't really a demon that you can't say very much good about him. But what this demon really wants, and we finally get to meet the demon, and we finally get to find out what the demon is trying to do here. What the demon really wants is for David to help convince people that he's real. This is the demon's purpose. This is what's behind all of this. David, he wants David to be his spokesperson. And he's trying to get David, manipulate David to do this. Now, David, of course, doesn't. He doesn't want to, and he's not going to. All David's concerned with is saving the soul of his daughter, which he won't quite realize that he's talking about actually saving his daughter, but really what he's trying to do is save her soul. So he's not concerned about supporting the demon's agenda, but the reason why the demon thinks that he will, and all is because Milton's Paradise Lost, let's get back to that for a minute, in using Paradise Lost as the big black book to base this whole thing on, like I said originally, most writers in a story like this, that if they didn't want to be yet another person trying to validate a Necronomicon, they would pick a book like the Lamegaton or the Key of Solomon or something like that. But instead of that, it's Paradise Lost, and yet Paradise Lost is actually the perfect book for this sort of thing, and the reason is that what Milton did with this poem was he laid out the whole story of the fallen angels. He laid out the whole, he made this tremendous epic in which Lucifer, or Satan, if you want to call him that, the angel that God and his angels throw out of heaven is in a way a kind of a dark hero. And this war in heaven, it's a two-sided thing, because Satan and his angels, their only sin really is pride, and they give human beings knowledge, and they give, it's exacts a terrible price on human beings and on them too, but so we have a kind of a Faustian theme here, and Milton himself, although Milton was originally studying for the priesthood, he ended up being a Republican and very much interested in Cromwell's anti-royalist revolution, and which got him in a lot of trouble too, by the way, and. Milton would have been a Mason. He would very definitely have been a Mason if he'd lived 100 years later, or even 75 years later. He certainly would have been, because he was very forward thinking, and he was also what we would call a monist. In other words, he didn't believe that there was God on one side, the great God of light, and then the awful God of darkness on the other side, and nothing in between except good and evil. That wasn't Milton. Milton was a monist. He believed that good and evil were all necessary parts of the universal whole, which meant that he actually could, even though he, being a good boy, he did write it, pretty much try to be on the side of Jehovah and his angels, but you could read between the lines in Milton, and you could get to where you could, if you were like William Blake, and you could read between the lines, and you could actually get to thinking that the devil and his crew were not so bad after all. William Blake certainly thought so, and William Blake you know, was an Arden Swedenborg in for a while, and it was Swedenborg was just so goody-goody-goody, and Swedenborg thought that any kind of artistic expression was vanity and all of that. And Blake, you know, was a pre-thinker, and he was an artist. He was experimenting with nudism and free sex and all this kind of stuff. And he said, oh, come on, I got to get... Yeah, so he kicked over Swedenborg and wrote a little beautiful little book called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Now, this is Marriage of Heaven and Hell is actually kind of Milton reading between the lines. Now, this is why the Paradise Lost is a very, very, very good base book on which to have the demonologist, in other words, David Ulmer, the character. This is a very good thing for him to be a student of and lecturing on. And he's raised a Catholic, but he himself thinks he's an atheist. He's perfect. He has a background. Another thing about this book that is really, really great is that David, we learn more and more about David's terrible childhood and his father, that his father was an alcoholic, an awful person who when David's brother drowned, his father blamed him, and actually turns out that his father was responsible for his brother drowning, and David had been in denial on that, accepted the guilt for it himself. And this personal tragedy that he had, this is all wrapped up in the story. Now, this is very important because demons, as we know, those of us, you know, who know something about them, demons are parts of us. They're just as much, when you're dealing with a demon, you're dealing with something that is the strongest part of that demon is the part of that demon that's in you. Now that demon is in you, and his or her power comes from your own tragedies and your own problems and your own psychological hang-ups. That's what that demon feeds on, and that's what give that demon power. And so our background, our history, all the way back. And, of course, you know, you say the same thing about the space brothers that you talk to. Perhaps they, you know, the other people we contact, you say, well, you know, we've been contacted ever since I was a child. Well, what does that tell you? It doesn't tell you. Frankly, if you take a hermetic view, you can say, well, maybe you were. Maybe that contactee, maybe that alien really has a counterpart out there in the universe. But if you were contacted when you were a child, it's playing off your emotions. It's gaining power from your emotions, your particular traumas, and your particular makeup. And this is the thing about demons that the average Hollywood screenwriter or an average novelist just not only he may understand it, but he doesn't want to write it that way because he doesn't think people will relate to it. Well, I think they will, and I think the fact that this book that David is so effective, or Andrews is so effective, is because I think inside, deep down inside us, we all know this is true. And Andrew has, in his book here, has played on that. And he's played on that deep, deep-seated knowledge inside us that we know that these demons are, they're primarily inside us. And then, yeah, sure, they have an archetype, and they'll draw power from that archetype, too. So, my Baal and my Astaroth is going to be different than yours, but it is kind of a collective. If you follow the Jungian principle, it's a collective archetype, and the collective archetype, and the deeper and the further back that collective archetype goes, the more powerful it is, And your particular channel of that archetype draws power from that collective. Now, this is not a concept that some people would like to have. They'd like to have everything outside. You know, they don't want to admit that any of this is part of them. They'd like it to come from somewhere else. But matter of fact is, it doesn't, and I think all of us know subconsciously that this is true. And this is what gives the demonologist, the book The Demonologist, its power. Because he plays on this, and the writer plays on this. Also, the coincidences. We have all experienced meeting people that we felt knew more about us than they should, or people who seem to have a hidden knowledge, and people who appear, the important thing here on this psychological analog is that this also puts us in touch with ghosts, especially ghosts of our own family. He is confronting Andrew has David Ullman confronting his own father as we get toward the climax of this, because the tragedy of his father and his brother is so much a part of this thing. So as we progress further and further into this, we get deeper and deeper into David Ullman's own past. And this here again lends power to the story. And and yet at the same time, he has the suspense curve, and he has the obligatory first act hook and third act hook and all the various things you have to do to write a good thriller. He's got them, but he is calling on a depth here. And especially these ghosts, these encounters with these ghosts, because quite often we encounter our parents or dead parents, especially in our dreams, and we go back and then we've all had the experience, as I say, of meeting people, strangers that are mysteriously knowledgeable. One of the things I want to do, in the course of this, is I want to read a little bit here out of Milton's Paradise Lost to show you some of the nature of how Milton's ideas of this worked out, so you can see why how effective this is. Now, let me try to spot it right here. Let's see. Of Solomon he led by fraud to build his temple right against the temple of God. On that opprobrious hill, and made his grove the pleasant valley of Hinnom. Tophet thence, and black Gehenna called the type of hell next Chenos. The obscene dread of Moab's sons from Error to Nebo, and the wild of southmost Abrim, to Hesebon and Horonam, and Sion's realm beyond the flowery dale of Simla, clad with vain vines, and Eclay to the asphytic pool. Peor, his other name, when he enticed Israel to Sittim, on their march from Nile, to do him wanton rites which cost them woe. Yet thence his lustful orgies he enlarged, even to that hill of scandal by the grove of Moloch homicide, lust hard by hate, till good Joshua drove them thence to hell. And with those came they who from the bordering flood of old Euphrates to the brook that parts Egypt from Syrian ground, had general names of Baalim and Ashtaroth, those male, these feminine, for spirits when they please can either sex assume, for both so soft and uncompounded is their essence pure, not tied or mandated with joint or limb, nor founded on the brittle strength of bones like cumbrous flesh, but in what shapes they choose, dilated or condensed, bright or obscure, can execute their airy purpose and works of love or enmity fulfill. For those the race of Israel oft forsook their living strength and unfrequented left his righteous altar howling lowly down to bestial gods, for which their heads are low and bowed down in battle, sunk before the spear of despicable foes. With those in troop came Ashtaroth, whom the Phoenicians called Astarte, queen of heaven, with the crescent horns to whose bright image, nightly by the moon, Sidonian virgins paid their vows and songs in Sion, also not unsung, where stood her temple on the offensive mountain built by the noxious king whose heart, though large, beguiled by fair idolatrous, fell to idols foul. Tammuz came next behind, whose annual wound in Lebanon allured Assyrian damsels to lament his fate in amorous ditties on a summer day, while smooth Adonis from his native rock ran purple to the sea, supposed with blood of Tammuz yearly wounded the love tale, infected Sion's daughters with like heat, whose wanton passions in the sacred porch Ezekiel saw, and by his vision led, his eyes surveyed the dark idolatries of alienated Judah. Next came one who mourned in earnest when the captives ark, maimed by his brute image, head and hands lopped off in his own temples on the Grinsor edge, where he fell flat and shamed his worshippers. Dagon, his name, sea monster, upward man and downward fish, and yet had his temple high, reared in Azotis, dreaded through the coast of Palestine, in Gath and Ascalon, in Acheron and Gaza's frontier, bounds him followed Rhiannon, whose delightful seat was fair Damascus on the fertile banks of Abna and Farfar, lucid streams. He also against the house of God was, hope old a leper once he lost and gained became. Ahaz, his sotish conqueror, whom he drew God's altar to disparage and displace, from one of Syrian mode and whereon to burn his odious offerings and adore the gods, whom he had vanquished after these appeared a crew whose under names of old renowned Osiris, Isis, Horus and their train, with monstrous shapes and sorcerers abused, fanatic Egypt and her priests to seek their wandering gods disguised in brutish forms rather than human, nor did Israel escape the infection when their borrowed gold composed the calf of Oreb and the rebel king. Now, I think Milton touched all the bases, didn't he? In fact, what he just did there, whether I suppose I'm not the greatest reader of Milton, but you can tell from there that Milton is giving us a catalog of the pagan gods we know and love, and justifying them as minions of Satan, and therefore. Milton is producing here a very popular grimoire. Yeah, this book went through many, many editions, and I won't say it was read by as many people as read today, because this was a little bit before that. I think it's printing press. They were printing them. And this was well read. This was popular, and so consequently, this had more of an influence on people than these copies of the Lemegaton, which they were copying by hand and sneaking around, and only people who read those were a very small number of people who were afraid they were going to still afraid they were going to get burned at the stake. So consequently, Paradise Lost is really, I would say, a seminal work on demonology. It really is. It was like this Necronomicon thing has become today. But Milton was a very good researcher, and he really knew what he was talking about. And he was an expert. He'd been a seminarian student. His Latin and his Greek and his and he read and was fluent in several languages. And his Latin was very good. So he knew what he was talking about. And yet this book of his, it's a prose poem, and it goes, and it's very extensive. This book of his is very popular. So consequently, this really is a very good, valid source for demonology. And you could actually see where the demon, in our particular case, which is one of the Satan's right-hand demons in Pandemonium, which is Milton's version of the Council of the Demons. And by the way, I'd like to mention, too, while I'm on that subject, Dan Brown is now out with one called Inferno, naturally on Dante's Inferno. And he's doing the same thing, apparently, with Dante's Inferno that Andrew Pryor has done with Piper has done with Paradise Lost, and this goes right down the line because Dante's Inferno is really another one of these things like Paradise Lost that defines the nature of the underworld, or the nature of the demons and their hierarchies and their lowerarchies and all of that to the general public. So the Inferno can be considered a popular grimoire. And I might add that we talk about actual grimoires, we talk about the Lemegaton, quite frankly. Even though it uses Kabbalah, its demonology is Dante-esque and Milton-esque. And this is not Jewish demonology. Jewish demonology is different. Klephoth is a whole different rationale than Tartarus, than the Christian Tartarus that Milton and Dante were both using. So we're looking forward to Dan Brown's in Inferno, and we'll see how this will compare to Andrew's the demonologist. Now, quite frankly, I would like to mention that the way that this book is written, you could really, with a few exaggerations, you can really say that yes, this whole thing is actually in a sense possible, and I am wondering, and I've always wondered, it just about the real authenticity of some of these versions of demonic exorcisms that we've seen ever since The Exorcist. Now, I don't doubt that young frustrated Catholic preteen girls can get pretty hysterical. I'm sure they can, but the real horror of demonology is, I think, in a subtler in a subtler sense. It's not so much the possessions, which are, frankly, as far as I've been able to tell, they're just as much poltergeist phenomenon as they are demonic possessions. The real danger in demonic possession is not possession so much as it is obsession. This is the, you know, those of us who work with them in a very controlled sort of way realize that people who become obsessed with them, this is not good. And they should never be. This should always be a phase of work that one goes through, that one masters these things and then moves on. And yet the impression in most popular fiction and in most films is that they come in with no prior predisposition, and they come in at random, and you catch it by somebody who is possessed, almost like a werewolf, almost like a Hollywood werewolf, where you get bitten and you get hit by one of these creatures, and then you get it, or they touch you and you get it, or you play with a Ouija board and they get it and you get it. No, this is not way what happens. And so I think maybe, hopefully, Andrew's book will be part of a new trend among writers who are dealing with the cult phenomenon, who will actually deal with it in a more realistic sort of way. And I think that this book proves that getting close to the real truth on this thing makes it even more frightening if you're intelligent enough and cognizant enough to realize it. It makes it more frightening because you realize, oh, this could happen to me. Anyway, the book, as I said, is The Demonologist. It's by Simon & Schuster, my Andrew Piper, and he's author of another novel called The Lost Girl. Several novels, actually. He's really made quite a career for himself, and this will make an excellent film. And Andrew right now he's living in Toronto, and we certainly enjoyed it, and we would very, very much recommend it. And at the same time, we're recommending Andrew's book. Let us also recommend Paradise Lost by Milton. And I think once you get into this, and granted, it's a little heavy, you know, you need to know your mythology. Good to have a mythological dictionary along with you when you read it. But when you get into Milton, you will realize just exactly why we say that Milton, along with Dante and Milton, and you might, the Hypno-Rautomantia, certain of these books that really, really were, by the Hypno-Rautomantia, by the way, is the one that kind of lies behind the Ninth Gate or the Club Dumas, that the Paradise Lost is very, very much worth reading and studying. It really is. Now, next week, right along with, spinning right on off from Paradise Lost, we thought that because we really want to do a little more, make a few more connections, one thing or another, before we deal with the Process Church of the Final Judgment. So we're going to probably put that off for another week. And so this next week, William Blake, and that follows right along after Paradise Lost, and because it very much influenced William Blake, and we can deal with William Blake and his contribution to occultism and to agenda. And of course, this marvelous little marriage of heaven and hell, and his spiritual battle with Swedenborg, which I appreciate. I said one time, you know, if you take a typical book by Swedenborg, they're about 16,000 pages long, and you remove every word good, everywhere Swedenborg has the word good, and you take that out, and you would cut the length of Swedenborg's book down by almost more than a half. There's a lot of goods in there. Do I have a call coming in? Who is it?
Just a listener.
Well, all right, just a listener. What can I do for you? Just a very, very short time. You've got to sign off pretty quick. What?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's enough time or not. I was just catching the tail end of the show, but I was kind of curious as to the Hermetic perspective on demons. I was raised in the Christian mythology, and so my understanding of demons is that they are a third of the rebellious angels that were cast
down. That's right.
Down
you got it.
Heaven. Yeah.
You got it. You got it. They're rebellious, and they're rebellious, and you got to handle them. You got to handle them like a lion tamer who loves his lions. You know? Yeah. You go in there with a whip and a tea. Go in there with a whip and a chair, and you love them. And you love them, and you feed them, and they're very important to you, and you really, really have affectionate, but never turn your back on them.
So
right?
In the Hermetic tradition, is it a subscription to the Christian mythological idea of a demon, or is it different?
We're okay with the Rosicrucians, and actually, Hermetic philosophy is never going to make a saint out of Hermes Trismegistus before somebody proved that. That he was actually post-Christian rather than pre-Christian, and then during the Renaissance, the Catholic Church knocked all the statues, and you know they kicked him out of the church. No, we're very compatible. We're very compatible with Christianity, but we also, like I said, Paradise Lost. You know, like I was saying tonight. The rebellious angels, actually, they are the knowledge, and the angels are the wisdom. Are they, you know, that kind of thing. It's a sort of a Faustian sort of a thing where the serpent gives you wisdom, but then God comes along and says, well, all right, now that you've got it, don't misuse it, you know. It's that sort of thing. Yeah, anyway, look.
I was going to say, do you feel like they're to be feared, or
no? Just read the material, and you'll realize what I'm saying is okay. We got to go.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so we're just about off, and as I said, next week, and this would answer his question actually, the guy you just asked, Blake's marvelous little book, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, because Blake was a Christian. Oh, he was an ardent Swedenborgian, and he just, well, wait a minute. I'm an artist. I'm a writer. I'm a poet. I'm proud of my work. What is all this business about all of the art and all of the writing and my artwork and everything else? And that's supposed to be vanity? Oh, come on, you know. And so this was Swedenborg's approach, you know, that you're just supposed to get down on your knees and spend all day praying, you know. And this is, no, come on. So this is why Blake wrote The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which we will discuss next week. And until then, good magic.